I'd like now to welcome Jeffrey West. He is the president of the Santa Fe Institute. He's a physicist, interdisciplinary scientist, actually, I should say. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte. Pleasure to be here.
You are a physicist who, as I was reading on the internet as I was preparing for this show, had actually sort of gone to graduate school as a way to get from England to California and intended to stay there for a year or two and then go back and be an English major. Didn't work out that way.
No, indeed. I'm slightly embarrassed that you did so much research on this. But indeed, yes, I originally came from the United Kingdom to indeed have experienced California. I'd heard all these wonderful things about California. This is way back in the early 60s, and this was a great excuse to come for at least a year, experience it, and then go back and lead a real life.
But that's not what happened.
I got very turned on during graduate school to physics, which I'd majored in as an undergraduate, but had not really been passionate about. And more I became excited by some of the deep questions in physics and realized that physics was a structure using mathematics and a conceptual way of thinking that could answer many of the questions that I was still, as I emerged from my adolescence, was still deeply troubling me. And may I say, trouble me even more now that I'm well into my 60s.
What are some of these questions? I mean, are we talking about why are we here, that kind of thing?
Yes, even at that level, sort of why are we here questions. But really, you know, what is the origin of the universe? How did it evolve? How did life begin? What is the nature of consciousness? Those were the sort of sophomoric kind of questions. I don't mean that as a pejorative term. But
and you actually dealt with those in graduate school?
No, but I talked a lot about them. Lots of talk. And in fact, I think the thing, as I look back, that actually kept me in physics and in California, and this was at Stanford, was that I happened to be with an extraordinary group of graduate students who were very interested in similar kinds of questions. So a lot of the time, we're in places like this,
sitting around in cafes.
Or sitting in, you know, little dorm rooms, talking about such questions, and seeing where physics, how we could use physics as a tool for beginning to answer them. It was somewhat naive, but it certainly formulated my whole approach to science, namely the focus on fundamental questions, fundamental principles, and how one can make them quantitative, predictive, within a kind of mathematical framework. And that has pretty much been what I've tried to spend the 30 or 40 years since trying to do.
Now, you ended up as a faculty member at Stanford in California, and then you were doing particle theory in Los Alamos National Laboratories, and now you're at the Santa Fe Institute. You have crossed disciplines probably more than many scientists, or perhaps more than most scientists, in the sense that you took physics, particle physics, but you went into biology and started looking at big questions in biology.
Yes, indeed. So, as you say, I was at Stanford for a number of years as a faculty member, and then I was lured to Los Alamos to start a new particle physics group, and we assembled a wonderful group. It was very exciting, and even though I only intended to come for a few number of years, in the end, remarkably, I'm still here. I mean, I'm not at Los Alamos, but I'm still in New Mexico. And but that group that we put together also was very eclectic, reflecting again broad interests. After about 20 years of doing that, dealing with fundamental questions. In high energy physics, particle physics, that is the question, what are the fundamental particles? What are the fundamental laws that govern the interaction between those particles? How does that relate to the evolution of the universe and the Big Bang? What's the nature of dark matter? All these kinds of questions. My interests in the 90s began to shift on a personal level into some similar fundamental questions in biology. And the one that originally stimulated me, interestingly enough, and it's natural enough, was the question of aging and death. Why is it that we're destined to age and destined to die? And how come that if you're a human being, you are destined to live for roughly 100 years? I mean, you may only live for 50 years, and you may actually be fortunate or to live for over 100 years, but you're not going to live for 1,000 years or a million years.
Or even 150 years.
Or 150 years even. And indeed, most human beings will live more than 10 or 15 years. So why is that? What sets the scale? And that was the kind of question that started to intrigue me and got me interested in generic deep questions in biology. And that ultimately got me involved in the Sanofi Institute, because the Sanofi Institute is an institution that was set up to strongly encourage, or as a, how can I say it, a safe haven for people moving across disciplines, because one of the sad facts that has evolved in academia over the last 20, 30 years especially, and even more so in the last 10 years, has been the tremendous pressure to work on very specific, detailed problems and to discourage broader thinking, especially broader thinking that crosses across disciplinary boundaries.
Where does this pressure come from?
This pressure comes primarily from the reward system, namely questions of promotion, tenure, grants, grant proposals. The
so it's hard
grants.
To get tenure for writing a book that addresses broader questions?
Well, it would be very hard if you were a physicist and several of your papers, most of your papers were dealing with applying physics to economics, or, you know, a collaboration that you might have had with an anthropologist trying to understand network structure of the Anasazi, for example. This would not get you tenure, and you would be hard-pressed to find anyone that would support that research. So that was recognized over 20 years ago by a bunch of very distinguished scientists, three of whom had Nobel Prizes, who were very concerned that kind of thinking, which is more risk-taking, more speculative, was more and more being suppressed, not necessarily consciously, just simply by the evolution of the academic landscape.
We're talking to Jeffrey West, president of the Santa Fe Institute. So let's cut to the chase here. Dogs live 8 to 16 years. Human beings live 80 to 100 years. Why?
Yeah, so this is a very... So one of the things you discover when you start thinking about these questions is asking... So first of all is to think about what is the framework of this question. The framework of this question is... What are the generic features? We're not going to be able to answer a question, let's talk about aging, how long Mary Charlotte is going to live, or how long Jeffrey West is going to live, but we may be able to answer how long will you live if you're a human being, an average human being, whose weight is of the order of 150 pounds. And at the same time, being able to answer the question you raise, if you're the average elephant, who may weigh, I don't know, many tons, how long do you expect to live?
So that's the kind of... Or a ferret, or snail,
or a snail,
or
whatever.
Or planarian.
That's right. So when you start thinking about this, if you start thinking about aging and death, one of the first things you want to start thinking about is what in the hell keeps you alive in the first place? And the process that keeps you alive, the fundamental process, is called metabolism. It's what people are doing all around us in this cafe. They're eating and drinking to provide the constituents, the resources to metabolize, create at a fundamental level a substance called ATP, which is your currency of energy, and that allows you to stay alive. That feeds everything that keeps you alive, everything from your circuitry, respiratory systems to your neural system. That keeps you alive. And one of the questions is, how does that change, first of all, as you change the scale of the organism? That is if I look at your metabolic rate, that is how much energy, how many food calories, for example, do you need per day to stay alive? Suppose you had, instead of being born a human being, you've been born a mouse. how much energy would you require to be a mouse, or had you been a blue whale, how much that would require. So it turns out when you look at that data, you find something extraordinary. That is, here we have this tremendous diversity of organisms, and you also have, you're dealing with a system that is probably the most complex possibly in the universe, and yet when you look at how metabolic rate, the amount of energy you need per second to stay alive, how that scales, how that changes as you go from, say, a mouse to an elephant to a whale, up through human beings and giraffes, you find that there is a very simple systematic relationship that allows you to characterize it. And mathematically, for those in the audience that have even the modest mathematical background, that scales as a what's called a power law with an exponent of 3/4. So let me explain what that means. Okay. in English. So that means that if I were to change, it's power to the 3/4, I said, and here's the 3/4, how it comes in. That is that if you were to increase the mass of the organism, the weight of the organism, by a factor of 10,000, that's 1 followed by 4 zeros, that's 4 orders of magnitude.
So mouse to
a very large mammal of the order, actually, of almost an elephant, actually. You would naively have expected, if you've increased it by a factor of 10,000, you've increased the number of cells by a factor of 10,000, you would require 10,000 times as much energy. But in fact, systematically, you only require 1,000 times as much energy, 3 orders of magnitude, 3 zeros after the 1. And that 3/4 is just a mathematical representation of the fact that if you increase by a factor of 10,000 or whatever the number is, you require a much smaller number amount of energy to actually sustain the organism. And this is a generic rule that not only works across all mammals, but indeed works across essentially all of life. That is, if you ask about the power, the energy required to sustain an individual cell, and you ask about the power to sustain a fish or a tree.
So small animals need more energy per body weight.
Exactly.
Than large
so
animals.
there is an economy of scale, meaning that the bigger you are, your cells require less energy to function. And incidentally, one thing that is amusing is to ask, how much energy do we need? Well, we actually need the number that's on your Kellogg's cornflakes box that says 2,000 food calories a day. That we're familiar with, so that's the number we're talking about. But what is amusing that most people don't recognize, if you translate that into scientific units, so to speak, watts, it's only 100 watts.
100
that is,
watts.
We operate.
One light bulb
we need
burning
a light,
all day long.
Oh, that's all we need to keep us alive, just to sustain ourselves. Now, in fact, the amount of energy you need to function, that is, sit around, have this chat, go to your shopping, and do your job. If you add all that up, it turns out that number is more like 200 to 300 watts, but it's still not very big, and it is a real representation of the extraordinary efficiency of life, and also represents the extraordinary inefficiency and wastefulness of leaving a light bulb on, because that light bulb
right.
effectively could be supporting someone that's starving in Darfur, effectively,
if you
could somehow
way,
translate
right.
it. So it's a real metric of...
Now, what is it about larger organisms that allows them to be more efficient? Is it something yes. about surface area to mass, or what's the...
No,
what?
So the work that I got involved in... So let me just continue with that line of thinking first. So here we have this extraordinarily simple and remarkable relationship about the amount of energy, which is very fundamental, of course, to life, how much you need to stay alive. But what is even more fascinating, so first it covers all of life, no matter if you look at the microscopic, at cellular level, or organisms of any taxonomic group.
But and all life has cells that are essentially the same.
The same, effectively the same. So the other fact is that if you looked at any physiological quantity, such as heart rate, such as lifespan we talked about earlier, such as more complex things like the diffusion of oxygen across the surface of your lungs. If you look at time to maturity, you look at any quantity, we could sit here and talk about 100 such quantities, you find a very, very similar kind of behavior. That is the scaling in a very systematic way. So with also this quarter coming up as a universal kind of number, the number 4 plays a sort of magical universal role in all of life. And what it says is that in this sort of coarse-grained generic behavior, a whale is a blown-up elephant, which is a blown-up giraffe, which is a blown-up gorilla, which is a blown-up human being, which is a blown-up mouse. We're actually just scaled up in this very peculiar, non-linear fashion,
right,
well-defined by the equations of each other,
right,
actually. And the thing that we look at as great differences are actually very small perturbations on top of this dominant background universal behavior that unites us all. We're all representations pretty much of the same thing. So now go to your question.
Yes.
What underlies this? So when I started thinking about this, I came up with an idea, which I will talk about in a second. But I was very fortunate to start a collaboration through the Santa Fe Institute, even though I was not part of the Santa Fe Institute at the time, with a very distinguished ecologist named James Brown at the University of New Mexico. He had just arrived about a year earlier, and he's a very distinguished man, and a student of his named Brian Enquist, who himself is now becoming a distinguished biologist at the University of Arizona, professor at the University of Arizona. So when we put all this work together, here's what we suggested was the origin of all this. The origin is that underlying life, what sustains life, are the multiple networks of which we are comprised. So when you think of yourself, you think of yourself as this nice, smooth surface with a, you know, head and a body and arms and so on. But what is actually you, what is functioning as you, even your very brain, are in fact hierarchical branching networks. The most familiar being your circuitry system with a heart pumping blood through a hierarchy of arteries, leading down to capillaries, very much like a complex road network. And what you realize when you think about yourself is that you are, in fact, a conglomeration of such networks. You're a circuitry system, a respiratory system, a renal system, a neural system. If you look at pictures of your brain, it is structured this way. So that's who you are. That's who we are, we meaning all life. And so what we did is we started realizing that these scaling laws are actually a manifestation of the generic, universal, mathematical properties of these networks that are controlled by the physics and mathematics that are integral to network structures. We started putting together a theory based on that, based on the nature of these networks, a mathematical theory, which not only explained these rules, it naturally gave rise to this infamous quarter power, the 3/4, the 3/4 I mentioned earlier at the beginning on metabolic rate, but everything else. One of the things that came out of this was a remarkable universality in terms of things like all time scales in life, and conversely all rates. So time scales meaning things that we've discussed, lifespan, time to maturity, rates being things like heart rate, the rate at which we evolve. So these rates differ by enormous time scales. Evolutionary rates are...
Right, you can watch the evolution of moths, but not of human beings.
But not of human beings, but we do evolve, and we know the rate at which we've evolved. That is, technically, the rate at which nucleotides in your DNA have changed. We can measure such things, but there's time scales associated with that, but there's time scales associated with your heartbeat, heart rate. So what the theory says is that all of these no matter what they are governed by a very simple mathematical law coming out of the constraints of networks, and that is, again, to use a technical language, a power law with a scaling exponent of 1/4, this 1/4, so that, for example, going back to the increasing of weight by 10,000, your metabolic rate only increases by a factor of 1,000, and your heart rate, according to this, only increases by a factor of 10. And let me go back now to the question of aging. Aging is a secondary effect in this, and that is that aging in this theory comes about through the continuous degradation that occurs through these networks. So the great irony of these networks is the following. These are networks that I said sustain you, but these networks also have what physicists call dissipative forces. That is, they have friction in them, and they wear. They are continually wearing, just like even the pipes that water flows through your house and your plumbing, they wear.
And the circulatory system would be a direct analogy.
Circulatory wears. It wears. Now, we do repair. But natural selection is at work here, and natural selection only cares that, for example, if you're a human being, that we live only till we're 35 or 40, we produce 15 kids, 20 in our natural state, produce 15 kids, of which maybe 10 will survive. But once we've done that, natural selection doesn't care. It only provides enough repair mechanism. And indeed, there's a huge amount of energy we put into repairing ourselves to live to 40 or so. And one of the questions one could ask is how long, if you actually were to have a highly efficient repair system, and you were free of disease, how long could you conceivably live? And this theory answers that question in principle, and although it's a highly complex phenomenon, but it does give rise to the theory, if you take this wear and tear version and apply the network mathematics, you discover that the scaling of lifespan is indeed of this nature, this 1/4 power. You can also apply it to other things like evolution. You can apply it to sleep. I mean, one question that one might ask is, why is it we need to sleep? Why do we need to sleep? And why do we need to sleep 8 hours? Why can't we get by with an hour? And why is it that a mouse has to sleep 16 or 17 hours? And the theory similarly can answer that question, because it's surprisingly related to aging and mortality, because just as I said, you age because of the degeneration of the system due to these dissipated wear and tear forces, so it is within your brain. But the brain, of course, is a very unique and special organ, because it controls everything. It is the central control system. And you better repair that brain faithfully, because if you don't, there will be a continuous change in the individual. And furthermore, if you try to repair it while it's operating the whole system, you will have serious problems. So you need a downtime. Just as if you're in New York City, if they want to repair Fifth Avenue, they have to do is shut at night. They have to shut down everything. That's what we do. We have to do that on a daily basis. We shut down so that we can make the repairs. And if you go through that whole mechanism, you can discover why it is that a mouse has to sleep 16 relative to a human being sleeping 8. And guess what? How long do you think an elephant has to sleep?
4 hours.
It does indeed. It sleeps 3 or 4 hours.
Well, on that note, we are going to go into our waking day. Jeffrey West, I want to thank you so much for being here on the Santa Fe Radio Cafe.